The Battle for Liberty, Episode 10.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
And we're back. Thanks again for joining me on another episode of the Battle for Liberty. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Tilden. Want to welcome you back to the podcast dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. Before we get started, I want to run you through all the normal reminders. Please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Really helps me out. If you could do one better, I'd love it if you could tell a friend about the show so we can grow our listener base. Find that person who you think is open to the idea of liberty and freedom and tell them, hey, I got a great show for you. Go check it out at battleforliberty.com. All of the information you need is up at the website. You want to follow me on Twitter at @mybattleliberty. If you're not doing that already, I don't know what I can say. You got to follow me on Twitter. You want to email me? That's easy. It's mike@battleforliberty.com. And once again, we'll have a show notes page today. It's battleforliberty.com/10. That's that one convenient location for all of the content that we're going to talk about on this episode. All right. Well, it's been a phenomenal two-week break for me and for my family. It's been a couple weeks since I put an episode out. It marks the first time since I started the show where I took a week off. And I really appreciate your understanding with that break. I do have some normal listeners. You might be thinking, no, it's really just your family. But that's actually not true. My statistics are showing me that more and more people are listening to the show all the time. And I really appreciate you understanding when I take a break. As I said at the very beginning of this endeavor, this isn't my full-time gig. I'm not really making a ton of money on this, and so I've got a full-time job and a family and two very young children. So there are going to be weeks every now and again where I can't put an episode out, and last week was one of those weeks. But you have my word that it's not because I don't love this effort. This is a labor of love, truly. It's a lot of effort, but it's worth every minute of it for me. I hope it's worth every minute for you as well. So last week, the wife and I took our first trip away from our children together since they were born. That's going on 3 years now, so it was much needed. It was really difficult to be away from the kids, but totally worth it. We went to, good old vacation destination Pittsburgh to celebrate the wedding of a dear friend. I think next time we'll pick another location so that we can come back and I can tell you about, how glamorous it was in Hawaii or in Fiji or, I don't know, some other tropical paradise. But we had a blast. I was in the wedding party, so it was a jam-packed weekend. We didn't have a lot of time to sit around and do nothing. We did shop for tuxedos and get fitted, and my wife needed to buy a couple dresses and gifts and things like that. And then we had the rehearsal and the dinner and the wedding itself, and it was a busy time, but boy did we have fun. But I'm back to reality, back to work. And so, of course, what's one of the first things on my mind when I come back? Well, of course, it's the Battle for Liberty podcast. So we are going to jump right in here. We are going to continue our discussion of voluntarism. I want to follow up on the last episode, which was episode number 9. And if you haven't listened to it yet, I really recommend going back and listening to that. You don't have to listen to one or the other in any particular order, because I'm going to recap here in episode number 10. So it's okay. You can listen in any order you'd like, but you can find that episode at battleforliberty.com/9 or in any of your podcatching apps. So in episode 9, I began to explain to you about the concept of voluntarism, which I explained as what I would call a better term to use when you're introducing someone to anarchy and anarcho-capitalism. In short, what I described to you is that when most people hear the words anarchy or anarcho-capitalism, instantly their minds are filled with images of a society filled with masked bandits, robber barons, and other morally bankrupt caricatures. They hear anarchy and they think chaos. But of course, anarchy is not the wild, wild west that you learned about in elementary school. No, indeed, anarchy is simply a state of being in which nobody possesses a monopoly on the use of force over anybody else. They hear capitalism and they think Scrooge McDuck swimming in a pile of money, which, by the way, I always thought that would be really painful and really dirty. Money is just disgusting, but never mind all that. The point that I was trying to make is that anarcho-capitalism has a marketing problem. Right? Anarchy, people think chaos. Capitalism, people think greed. So greedy chaos is what people wind up thinking. And that's, of course, exactly what mainstream media and mainstream thought police want you to think. But that's not the truth. So the point that I tried to make is that, you know, anarcho-capitalism has this marketing problem. And I want to flesh that out just a little bit more here. I want you to think of yourself as a door-to-door salesman, and you have a potential customer, you ring the doorbell, they open the door, and you say, "Hi, I'd like to talk to you about anarcho-capitalism," and boom, that's right when they slam the door in your face. Okay? You see how that works? I mean, that the term by itself is enough to have someone say, "No, no, no, you're crazy, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with you." So we have to ask ourselves, how do we overcome this obstacle? Should one of the options and one of the questions people ask themselves is, should we water down the message? Should we change our principles? Should we favor only the respectable positions in the liberty movement, only the allowable opinions? And some would say yes to this strategy. They'd have you believe that it's part of a larger scheme in which you gradually move opinions, starting with the low-hanging fruit and moving slowly towards, you know, eventually abolition of all taxes or a complete end to the drug war in its entirety, even the hard stuff. But that you can't start out with that because you'll frighten people. And so you have to water down the message initially. And I want to tell you first and foremost, that strategy is flawed. In fact, it's crucial that we never water down the message in favor of gaining a few more supporters here and there. We really mustn't be afraid to be unapologetically ideological when it comes to our principles. And I want to rely on someone far more authoritative on this point than I will ever be. And of course, that's going to be Murray Rothbard. I say Murray like he's my friend. Rothbard said in his timeless manifesto for a new liberty, he said, quote, "To prefer a gradual whittling away to immediate abolition of an evil and coercive institution is to ratify and sanction such evil, and therefore to violate libertarian principles. As the great abolitionist of slavery and libertarian William Lloyd Garrison explained, urge immediate abolition as earnestly as we may, it will, alas, be gradual abolition in the end. We have never said that slavery would be overthrown by a single blow. That it ought to be, we shall always contend." So what Rothbard and Garrison are saying, essentially, is that you can't water down the message in favor of a gradual change. History has shown that if you choose that particular strategy, you will inevitably lose sight of your principles because you're going to spend so much time lobbying and fighting for the half measures that you'll eventually sanction those half measures and become the spokesperson for those half measures. You will eventually come to fight only for those half measures, which of course violate your own principles and destroy all of your credibility. You'll become your own worst enemy. Rothbard continues later in that same book, quote, "By concentrating on the immediate means, you help liquidate the ultimate goal and therefore the point of being a libertarian in the first place. If libertarians refuse to hold aloft the banner of the pure principle of the ultimate goal, then who will? The answer is no one." And I think that's just a perfect explanation of why watering down the message is just never the answer. It's never effective, and it just doesn't work. So we have to ask if the answer to what I call a marketing problem isn't to water down the message, then how can we solve the problem of what people think is a nasty term in anarcho-capitalism? And it turns out, as I described in the last episode, I think the term voluntarism solves this problem quite nicely. All at once, I think this term stays true to libertarian principles, but avoids the negative connotation of anarchy and anarcho-capitalism. You see, it gives you an opportunity to speak about the main tenets of liberty without alienating your audience. You see, it's easy to draw someone in with the notion that human interaction should be voluntary. Who's going to disagree with that, right? You're building trust instantly. Your audience hears, hey, yeah, I agree with that. I'm just like him. Let me listen to something else that he has to say. And of course, that principle of voluntary human interaction, that's all that anarcho-capitalism is all about. But voluntarism is a much softer term. And in the end, it carries all of the bite of anarcho-capitalism, but with far less bark. So once you've got your audience listening, you can help them reason their way to some of what I call uncomfortable logical conclusions that are inevitable. So I spent almost the entire episode in episode number 9 dealing with just one of those uncomfortable logical conclusions, and that was the fact that taxation is theft and is ultimately and definitively immoral. And that was a great episode. I think we did it justice. Go back and listen to it if you haven't. But I want to spend the rest of our time here today talking about some of the other uncomfortable logical conclusions that come from the concept of voluntarism. And so we'll start with national defense. A very common objection raised as it relates to a completely voluntary society is that without a state, we'd all be at constant risk of being taken over by some foreign power. And at the very outset, I feel this objection falls flat on its face. And that's because I believe that it conflates non-aggression with pacifism. So again, I'm going to quote Rothbard, this time from an essay titled War, Peace, and the State. And in it, Rothbard says, quote, "The fundamental axiom of libertarian theory is that no one may threaten or commit violence, in parentheses, aggress, against another man's person or property. Violence may be employed only against the man who commits such violence, that is, only defensively against the aggressive violence of another. In short, no violence may be employed against a non-aggressor. Here is the fundamental rule from which can be deduced the entire corpus of libertarian theory," end quote. So right away, we see that libertarians are not the same as pacifists, right? Pacifists, they seek to avoid violence at all costs, whereas libertarians, or voluntarists for the sake of this episode, they seek to avoid aggression. See, to the libertarian, there is a proper role for self-defense, so long as that defense is strictly targeted towards the aggressor. Interestingly enough, I think it's worth pointing out that Rothbard brings to our attention that even pacifists recognize the right to self-defense. However, they urge people not to exercise that right. So it's not like pacifists, they don't even say that the right to self-defense doesn't exist. They just simply don't want to use it. So pretty much everyone is in agreement that self-defense is a right, and libertarians believe that it is okay to use self-defense, again, so long as it's strictly targeted and scrutinized heavily. Okay, so we see that pacifism and non-aggression is not the same thing. So anyone who thinks, my objection is that if someone tried to come invade me, libertarians would have us lay down our arms and be conquered. Well, that's not the case. So we do then have to ask, without a state, who will provide for the common defense of, any number of groups of people? And it's a great question. So to begin to answer this question, I actually want to share with you, I'm going to describe a little bit later why, but this is actually, I think, it's got to be my favorite Rothbard quote of all time. Again, this is from War, Peace, and the State, and it starts here. Quote, "In the modern world, each land area is ruled over by a state organization, but there are a number of states scattered over the earth, each with a monopoly of violence over its own territory. No superstate exists with a monopoly of violence over the entire world, and so a state of anarchy exists between the several states. It has always been a source of wonder, incidentally, to this writer, how the same conservatives who denounce as lunatic any proposal for eliminating a monopoly of violence over a given territory, and thus leaving private individuals without an overlord, should be equally insistent upon leaving states without an overlord to settle disputes between them. The former is always denounced as crackpot anarchism, and the latter is hailed as preserving independence and national sovereignty from world government." Now, there's a lot packed into that, but I gotta tell you, that single passage sums up why I am fully on board with being an anarchist. Back in episode number one, I told my story of how I became a libertarian, but my journey was pretty long, and there really wasn't a point where I was converted overnight like some people were. I often joke about how, you know, what's a libertarian's favorite thing to do, and it's sit around and talk to all of his friends about how they became libertarians. That's funny, but it's actually kind of true. That's something that I definitely enjoy hearing other people's stories. So I didn't have an overnight conversion story like some people do. The closest I come to an aha moment was the first time I read that passage. I think at the time I read it, I was probably 80% big L libertarian and 20% anarchist. You know, at that point, it had been several years even to get to that point. And then with this one Rothbard passage, that was the nail in the coffin. That was it. I was sold. My status days were truly over, because Rothbard brings up just an unbelievably salient point of logic. And that's that, wait, we have these conservatives who say that we must maintain our national sovereignty and avoid world government, basically arguing for states to live in a state of anarchy. But then for individuals to live in a state of anarchy, oh, well, no, that would be just crackpot, right? No, they clearly recognize that it's far better for these states to not have an overlord, that they will govern themselves far better than if there was some sort of worldwide overlord. Well, then, why can't we remove the overlord from our local state? And when I say local state, I'm actually referring to the United States, because de facto the U.S. is a nation in today's world. That's a whole nother podcast we can talk about. You know, what is the United States? What was it designed to be, and all that kind of stuff. But let's get back to where we were going with this. So to remind you of what the original question was that led me to that passage, the question was, without a state, who will provide for the common defense of any number of various groups of people throughout the world? Well, by now, I hope the question is beginning to answer itself, okay? First and foremost, one simple truth that we can observe from that Rothbard passage is that invasion and war is typically something that happens between states themselves. So in a stateless society, these types of wars would be few and far between indeed. Second, for those of you who say, well, few and far between might be rare, but I still need to provide for defense in a catastrophic situation in which, say, a madman overlord invades our peaceful little society. Okay, yeah, that's a fair concern, and I share it. So I'll address it by, again, quoting, this time from what I consider to be a very powerful essay titled "Mercenaries, Guerrillas, Militias, and the Defense of Minimal States in a Free Society." And this one's by Joseph R. Stromberg, and it goes like this. Quote, "A tax-funded protection agency is a contradiction in terms and will lead to ever more taxes and less protection. The sheer number of people killed by states in the 20th century, up to 100 million, with more killed in peacetime social reconstruction than in wars, makes one suspect that state-provided security is extremely expensive in all respects, and that meaningful alternatives have been overlooked. One proposal in the literature is for market-based defense undertaken by competing insurance companies, which, in time, replace states. End quote. Now, that may sound crazy to you, but let's contemplate it together a little further. Think about it this way. This is how I think about it, at least. In what other areas of your life do you consider the loss of great amounts of property or your life to be a very small risk, but one that you feel compelled to protect against? Well, I say those major areas come to mind, and they are life and your major pieces of property, namely your home and your vehicles. So what mechanism exists to protect you from those types of losses? Well, of course, the answer is insurance. It turns out that there are tons of private companies who exist purely to provide you with a product that you cannot provide for yourself. And you can pay a competitive rate to insure yourself against the loss of your health, your home, your life, your other major property. And so, of course, the argument has to go, well, why can't you insure against the threat of physical violence or invasion? Well, of course, you could. We just don't think about it that way because the government has the monopoly on common defense. So that's a very interesting an interesting way of thinking about it, and certainly to be forthright, I'm still contemplating that one. But it's not that that's not as far as it goes. We can go much farther. The next thing that comes to mind is, well, there's nothing that stops a voluntary society from raising a militia. Of course, voluntarily. A libertarian would be 100% opposed to conscription, but there's nothing wrong with a voluntary militia. Voluntary militias have been quite successful throughout world history, so that's an option. And finally, if we're truly as a society, if we're going to limit our use of violence as a society to a defensive posture only, you've got to remember, as Stromberg further points out, quote, "We start from the truism that defense has the advantage. Already in 1861, the rifle gave defenders at least a 3-to-1 advantage." Now, of course, he's referring to the Civil War there. "And once people are driven to guerrilla tactics, defeating them raises the ratio of attackers to defenders to somewhere between 4-to-1 or 6-to-1, possibly higher. Successful pacification and occupation may require a 10-to-1 superiority. This shifts costs in all senses massively to the attackers. This is why Britain drew so much manpower from Canada, New Zealand, and Australia to defeat a few, quote, Dutch farmers. The final outcome, of course, still hinges on such factors as weaponry, geography, ideology, morale, leadership, but determined defenders may outlast all but the most powerful, wealthy, and vicious foes." End quote. That's a really powerful thing to remember. Look at world history. It's always the defenders that have the advantage. Think about what Stromberg just said there. In order for an invading force to be successful, they typically have to raise their ratio possibly to as high as 10-to-1. So you got to have 10-to-1 manpower in order to take over a force on their home field. So that's no small argument in and of itself. But I've got one more for you, and it's a little bit shorter, but it's a good one. And it's what I call the amazing contradiction of government-provided security services. And this comes from Walter Block, who explains why it's insane to think that any government-provided security service can actually perform its intended services. In an essay titled "National Defense and the Theory of Externalities, Public Goods, and Clubs," he says, quote, "To argue that a tax-collecting government can legitimately protect its citizens against aggression is to contradict oneself, since such an entity starts off the entire process by doing the very opposite of protecting those under its control." The government, by its very essence, does two things to its citizens incompatible with this claim. First, it forces the citizenry to enroll in its defense activities, and second, it prohibits others who wish to offer protection to clients in its geographical area from making such contracts with them in preference to the one it itself offers to them under duress. If true protection from violence includes the government itself, and there's no reason that it shouldn't, then it is this entity which is the prime rights violator. The state here is indistinguishable from the mafia chieftain who tells his victim he will protect her from himself. So that was a lot packed in there, but basically what Walter Block is saying is that it's a contradiction if a state run defense system tells you that it's going to protect its citizens, because by its very nature, because government is force, by its very nature, it's not going to protect you. And in fact, it's going to keep you from getting a better type of protection that someone else might offer. And, you know, as you heard in the quote, he claims that it's no different from a mafia who will say, well, we'll protect you from us. And I think that's a good way to look at it. And you may not agree, and that's okay, but I've provided here several different responses to the claim that voluntarists or libertarians or anarcho-capitalism, they wouldn't be able to provide for a national defense, and I think that's flat-out wrong. So let's just real quick summarize. So what we've gone through here, number one, non-aggression is not pacifism. There is a place for violence in the proper application of self-defense, okay, so long as that self-defense is targeted towards the aggressor. Number two, we trust states all over the world to live in a state of anarchy themselves with no common ruler empowered to use force legitimately. So why wouldn't we choose to apply that to the same state closer to home? Makes no sense. Number three, the vast majority of invasions and wars are fought by states themselves, not individuals. So the elimination of the state would actually help to reduce the massive amounts of violence inflicted at the hands of the state. Number four, for the remaining risk of invasion upon your local territory, the free market would be far better prepared and incentivized to provide efficient protections, far better than any government agency ever could. I mean, why is it that so many so-called conservatives completely distrust the government in every aspect of life? But when it comes to providing defense and conducting foreign affairs, well, all of a sudden the state is the only entity that can do it properly. That just doesn't follow. If you distrust them everywhere else, why do you just fall lockstep in with what they have to say about war and foreign affairs? Number five, if an invasion did come, which would probably be even less likely than it is with our current system of a state-monopolized defense force, you got to understand that as a defensive force, the odds are in your favor. History has shown us time and time again that the odds are in favor of the defensive force. Now, that doesn't mean they always win, but yeah, I think you're going to have better odds than you do even now. And number six, finally, it's downright nonsensical and contradictory to believe that the state is going to protect you when it does so by aggressing against you. It's organized crime, simply by another name. All right, well, once again, this has been another episode on voluntarism that I intended to cover numerous topics, but it turns out we focused solely on national defense. And again, as with last week, I'm okay with that. The topic was well worth our full devotion this week. I suspect, like last time, many of you aren't quite ready for this idea, or you haven't wrapped your brain around them fully. That's okay. I told you earlier in this episode, it's taken me many years to get where I am right now, and I'm sure my ideas will continue to evolve as time goes on. But that's what this is all about. I'm thrilled if you're even at the point where you're questioning your beliefs and ideas. That's where this all starts. So just like last week, when you're ready, send me a tweet at @MyBattleLiberty and let me know what you think of this episode and the ideas that I've displayed here. If Twitter isn't your thing, no worries. Give me an email at mike@battleforliberty.com. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and please refer that friend. Spread the word about the Battle for Liberty. Until next time, battle on.